Hello and welcome to Connectivity 232. I'm your host Nicholas Bray, and today I'm joined by Kelton Rice.
Hello everyone.
Hey Kelton, how's it going?
Doing good, Nick. How about you?
Yeah, pretty good. I mean, yeah, we're actually recording an episode, so yay.
Yeah, it's been forever, hasn't it?
We have had some struggles in the last few weeks, which is why this episode's a tad late, but here we are. And today we're probably going to be talking mostly about Zelda Breath of the Wild, seeing as though Kelton has just finished the game like a couple of days ago.
Yes.
But first, we'll maybe have a quick brief chat about what else we've been up to. So Kelton, what else have you been doing besides from playing Zelda?
Yikes. My goodness. So I have been playing my Switch religiously for, I would say, almost this entire year, but especially within the last month or so. Between ARMS and Splatoon, I never actually got a chance to play the first Splatoon, so I've actually been diving in really deep with Splatoon 2. Before I went back to finish Zelda, that was definitely eating up a lot of my time. I really, really enjoy Splatoon quite a bit. I've also been going back and playing just a few of the Switch games that I didn't get a chance to pick up that came out a little bit earlier in the year. I recently just picked up Cave Story, and I've been plowing through that, and that is phenomenal. Absolutely love that. And also, too, my Switch has actually kind of become one of the only consoles I actually own again. So I've got my 3DS, obviously, but the Switch has kind of overtaken my PlayStation. I hardly touched my PlayStation this year, so I am now just all Nintendo. So, kind of a nice little move of dedication to the company, because that's all I want to play at the moment. So, yeah, it's been plowing through a ton of stuff.
That sounds pretty good. I, on the other hand, haven't actually been playing much of anything lately, actually. I was going to pick up ARMS, and then I didn't. Then I was like, oh, yeah, Splatoon 2 comes out. And then I still haven't picked that up, so I've been a bit slack, just in terms of time and money, I guess, to buy the new games. But at this point, I'm probably looking towards Odyssey, maybe, as my next Switch game, aside from some download stuff, which I'll probably download Sonic Mania in a couple of days.
Yeah, that's right. That comes out next week.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm super excited about that one, too. I've kind of gotten this philosophy with the Switch since it's been out that if there is a game that I have even a passing interest in playing, if it's coming to the Switch, I will more than likely attempt to play it. Whereas with any other system, I wouldn't typically try. But because of just the versatility of the system, like I consistently find myself wanting to just always play the Switch no matter what.
So going back to Splatoon 2 for a sec, yeah, you didn't play the first one. I've played the first one. I played it a fair bit, like sort of trailed off after a while. But I'll probably end up getting the second one at some point. But so what do you like about Splatoon? Like, what's the thing you like about it so far?
Okay, cool. As far as Splatoon 2 goes, I've really been enjoying it. It's a lot different than other third-person shooters that I'm used to playing. So as I said earlier, I never played the first one, so the whole Turf War concept is completely new to me, but I found myself quickly getting really addicted to it. Just constantly the idea of covering the other team's turf with your ink, and just like it really takes the emphasis off kills, which is something I really appreciate as somebody who's not always great in multiplayers. I've really, really been enjoying the unique style of the game, considering that like all other third person shooters I've played are very like team deathmatch focused, and this one is just completely different, and I'm really, really loving it for that.
Yeah, the Turf Wars, I just like doing Turf War, because, yeah, you can sort of be okay at the game and still sort of, like, feel like you're playing sort of well.
Yeah, like, no, exactly.
Yeah, you don't have to really worry about killing people as much, like, that's what was good about it.
Yeah, no, I really, really love that aspect of the game. And another thing, too, that I really like about the Turf War matches themselves are that they only last about 3 minutes. So a lot of the times, like, I can't rely on my internet, you know, barely enough to record a podcast as much as I can for a multiplayer game. So the idea of, like, a match, like, hey, it's only going to be 3 minutes of time. It's a really concise, you know, shortcut amount of time. It's not going to take up too much to actually sit there and play it. And it's really, really nice. It works out really well for me.
Right, cool, yeah. So, yeah, you've been playing it a lot then, or just sort of every now and then? Like, have you been playing single player at all, or...?
Yeah, so single player, I've probably put... I know I'm at least done with the second section of the single player. I've been enjoying it a lot, more than I actually expected I would. But right now, because the Turf War is still so new to me and I'm still so hooked on it, that's kind of like the only, that seems to be taking all my attention, for the time being. I did, get to level, I think I'm level 13 or 14. And that was within a matter of a couple weeks, which is much faster leveling up than I'm used to for other multiplayer games. I definitely got through much faster, but that's because, like, that's all, like, I spent all my time just on Turf Wars alone, and I really enjoy the game. The one feature of it I haven't even, like, thought about touching is actually the voice chat of it. The voice chat feature seems so confusing, and even as somebody who's, like, the techie of my house who should be able to figure out how to set it up, I just don't want to take the time to try to set it up, so I just, for the most part, I just kind of use the app just to kind of check my Splatoon stats more than anything.
Yeah, yeah. And you can only chat with friends anyway, right?
I believe so, yeah.
With randoms. Yeah.
Which, yeah, I don't have a chance to play Splatoon with too many friends, seeing as most of the ones I have don't actually have a Switch yet. So it kind of leaves me out in the dirt a little bit, not being able to do any voice chatting. So, but to be honest, that's okay, because with it being a 3-minute match anyway, I feel like Nintendo does a really good job of applying their, like, level design to the multiplayer, like, with showing the player what they're supposed to do and getting things done to the level design in the multiplayer. So, yeah, I haven't really found a need for the voice chat at all, to be honest.
Alright, well, yeah, I haven't really been playing any games too much. I did play some N64 with a friend a few days ago. We basically just played some Mario Kart and Smash Brothers, but that was fun. We played the Japanese version of Mario Kart 64, where the voices are a bit different.
Yeah, that's right. I remember reading about that. Whose is it that's... isn't Luigi... Is Luigi's lower or higher in the Japanese one?
I couldn't say. I think... Yeah. Some of them sounded kind of close, but you could tell it was, like, a different person recording the dialogue.
Yeah.
Mario, I think, was exactly the same, so...
I think they kept Mario the same, but, yeah, I remember hearing that a few of the other voices are pretty drastically different. I think Toad and Wario were two of the standouts, from what I remember.
Yeah, and they've also got, like, advertisements based on real companies and stuff, like mobile and... There was, like, cigarette company in there. So, you know, advertising cigarettes to little kids in Japan.
Yeah, kind of unlike Nintendo, huh?
Okay, well, we shall move on to the chat about Zelda. We'll be talking sort of... We're not going to really be worrying about spoilers or anything, so if you still haven't, you know, finished the game or you haven't really... played it yet, like, you could just, you know, skip over this end of this show, and hopefully we'll be back with another episode in a couple of weeks. But anyway, so Kelton, what's your final sort of general thoughts on finishing Zelda, and, like, what was your experience like?
So the one thing that was, like, really stood out to me as I finished Breath of the Wild was just how much it still felt like a Zelda game when you beat it. So the whole experience is completely different than other, like, it really bucks the trend, you know, as we all know, of other Zelda games. But the thing I really appreciated about it was, even though, like, the whole journey up to that point to getting to Ganon, like, it was completely and individually mine, which is something that no other Zelda game has really, like, done before. Being able to, like, do everything my own way and be able to, like, craft Link's story up to the point where he has to defeat Ganon was really, really cool. And it added, like, a really nice emphasis. By the time that you actually defeat Ganon, like, you're like, all these things that I've done, like, I think I beat it clocking in around 75 hours. And that was only with, like, 70 shrines and, like, definitely not even 100 Korok seeds. So yeah, no, there was so much still left for me to do. But yeah, just beating it, I was really, really impressed with the boss fights and just everything about the game. I just was completely enthralled with.
Did you go into the boss fight with like having beaten all the beasts, the divine beasts?
Yeah, so I had actually attempted running in Ganon's castle. I think I want to say when I had gotten when I beat the Zora divine beast. This was like around probably the second or third week that it was out. I decided I would give it a shot just to see if I could actually get into the castle, try to get my bearings. I explored actually a lot of my exploration in Hyrule Castle was actually spent in like that time when I attempted it. And what I thought was cool was how the divine beast spirits that trap Ganon's soul or whatever it is inside of them, you actually have to fight them in the main hall, like before you fight the other two versions of Ganon at the end, which I didn't realize that if you beat the divine beasts, they just go away and then you just go straight to the Ganon fight like you would normally, but you have like four other Ganon fights if you don't beat the divine beasts, which is really cool.
I also went into the castle like early on, but I didn't try and go to like the Ganon fight really. I just sort of explored and tried to see what I could find in the castle, and I thought that was pretty fun because you're sort of really cautious, just sneaking around and not trying to get like laser beamed by guardians and stuff.
Oh my goodness, yeah. There's some really good. Yeah, it was really cool. Cause yeah. Oh, go ahead. Yeah.
I found the the Hylian shield pretty early on, so I was like, oh wow, that's cool. I just found it by accident, which is a surprise.
Yeah, no, that was really cool. I loved exploring the Hyrule Castle. Two of the things that really stood out to me when I was exploring the area was A, how the music changed. The music was incredible during that whole sequence. Just the way that like it took the normal Zelda theme, because like up until that point, I don't think they had really used the Zelda theme. I might be mistaken on that, but I don't remember hearing it up until you get to Hyrule Castle. And once you're in there, like, it just completely, like, it grows in nature, and it sort of, as somebody who's into music, like, it just sort of crescendos and just sort of builds this entire time that you're exploring. And so by the time that you finally hit Ganon, everything feels like the music does a really good job of culminating all of your, like, experiences thus far, and then by the time you defeat Ganon, like, it just feels incredibly epic.
Yeah.
And then the other thing, I was going to say, the other thing, too, that I really, really loved about the castle was actually, I believe it was Zelda's bedroom that you could, like, find where you would go in.
Yeah, I like that, too.
Yeah, you would go in and you would read her diary, which normally, like, text logs, I am of two minds of them. Some games do them very well, in Breath of the Wild's case, I think it did it really well. And some games can feel kind of lazy because it feels like they just kind of pepper them in just to add unnecessary lore, just to appease people who want a story like I do. But in here, it felt like it was actually pretty intricate and pretty like a sort of a fan service-y thing for anybody who enjoys heavy story elements from Zelda. So as somebody who really enjoys that, I really, really dug being able to just sit there and read her diary, sit there and like really flesh Link's character out and Zelda's perception of Link. That was something I was kind of surprised by. I've never seen or played a Zelda game where she didn't really like him at first, and then like over this, you know, over the course of him being her protector, he like grew to be this hero that we kind of know. And so then this is sort of like a redemption arc for him, which is really cool.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I also liked the thing I liked about the castle was like how I think it's the first time that the castle feels like it's actually like a real castle with like the correct rooms, and like it's not laid out like a dungeon, it's more like an actual castle in a way. Like,
yeah.
Like, yeah, you got her bedroom, you got like the kitchen, you got like the grand hall and stuff like that. Library, the dungeons. It's like,
yeah.
Yeah, actually exploring the castle this time was really cool. That was like, because back in when I originally played Ocarina of Time, I was always like, oh, I wonder what like the rest of the rooms in the castle look like. Because you basically don't see any of the castle. It's like a couple of hallways and you're done. in that game. So it was cool to be able to explore the castle properly this time.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. Just the feeling of, not only like the feeling like of isolation while you're there, but I really liked the feeling of this was like a lived in place before Calamity Ganon hit. Like the whole idea that, yeah, there was like, this was the like center of Hyrule. Like this was the spot where everybody would meet. And so it kind of made that post-apocalyptic feel of the game feel even more like credible, saying like, oh no, this is like, this is where people would come and they would like, you know, it was just felt very lived in, which I could really appreciate. Which is, like, the game felt more populated than I actually expected it to feel, which I found to be a pro, because when I first was, like, going into it, I knew that it was supposed to be, like, 100 years after this big, you know, big fight with Ganon, but I didn't really know if they would pull, like, you know, really pull, like, be able to pull people together and really be able to have sort of a cohesive world. But by the end of it, I definitely felt like it was a lot more fleshed out than I was expecting, which I really, really appreciated. Because it would have been so easy for them to say, oh, well, it's post-apocalyptic and, you know, everybody, there's stragglers and survivors. But no, it really felt like there was still, like, even though there was, like, a war that was going on, like, there was still people in pockets of civilization that were intact. And I really, really liked that.
Yeah, there was quite a few, like, well, there's obviously quite a few towns, and the world's pretty populated still. Like, it's, you know, it's sort of almost carried on as is, almost, aside from, like, you know, the around Hyrule Castle being all destroyed and stuff. But at the same time, like, I liked having a lot of the different characters and, like, inhabitants of the world and stuff, but at the same time, I never really felt, like, much of a connection to a lot of the, like, lesser characters or whatever. I also, like, a lot of them sort of merge together and I kind of forget who individuals are sometimes, like some of the townsfolk wandering around. Like, some of the more prominent ones, that's fine, but, like, I don't know, maybe it's just because there is so many that, you know, it doesn't really, they're just side dressing in a way anyway, but
yeah, I can definitely agree with that. I really actually don't have almost any complaints with this game, mainly just because it was one of the only games I've ever sat down to play where no matter, so I kind of have to be in the mood to play a game for long periods of time. One good example is like whenever I sit down to play Skyrim or something like that, I can get invested into it, but sometimes I feel like I need at least like an hour to kind of catch me up on where I've been and what I was doing. Whereas this game, I can start up like at any moment and just feel like, oh, okay, yep, I know exactly what I'm doing. I know exactly where I'm going. This is my goal. This is what I was thinking about last time I was playing it. I'm going to go see if I can knock out one of these quests on my log. And I think it really just, like, it shows how well Nintendo focuses on gameplay. Just the idea that, like, I enjoy controlling Link so much, almost the way, like, I enjoy controlling, like, Mario in, like, a Mario game. Like, it just felt so good to control Link. I was like, all I want to do is just sit there and play this game for hours. And it's one of the few Zelda games I feel like I could start up at any moment and just jump back into. Which is really, really cool, because I feel like I couldn't do that with almost any Zelda game, except for maybe, like, Link Between Worlds or Link to the Past.
So, like, yeah, the general world and stuff as well, that was something that a lot of people had been sort of wanting for like, a long time, and, like, I wrote, like, back in 2011 some article about saying what I basically wanted from Zelda, and this is, you know, it's probably as close as I'm going to get to what that was. It's pretty much exactly what I asked for, but, like, even went beyond what I was imagining at that time, because, you know, like, when I was envisioning an more open-world Zelda and, like, tackling things in any order and stuff, I always, I guess, assumed that they would keep the, like, the various Zelda items intact.
Yeah.
In this game, they went beyond that and just basically deleted all of them and gave you the tool set from the start. Which is kind of interesting. Did you like all that? Was it the open world Zelda something you were wanting for a while, or were you sort of content with the way things were, like, going, like, with Skyward Sword and stuff?
So I would say that probably around the time Twilight Princess hit, I was sort of approaching that not Zelda fatigue, but the same layout fatigue. And it wasn't really because I disliked the Zelda games. It was just because what I liked so much about Ocarina was it felt so special and so different. And so after, like, once you get to Twilight Princess, that sort of felt like a carbon copy, to some extent. Obviously, it was much bigger, had much more to do in it, but I felt like it kind of lost some of my attention just because it lacked some of that original, like, these big moments that you have in a Zelda game. And so what this one did is it kind of recaptured that feeling I had when I played Ocarina for the first time. Like, when I would go out into Hyrule Field and I would say, oh my gosh, look at this giant world, which, of course, at the time, Ocarina wasn't as big as I originally thought, but, like, Breath of the Wild's world is one of the biggest I've ever explored in a game, and I just am absolutely, like, in love with it. I just, all of the locations, and every time, like, a shrine comes up, like, this is the sort of game that, as a kid, I remember just being like, oh man, Zelda's cool, like, when I would play Ocarina of Time, but I'm like, it would be so cool if they would just, you know, make it just a little bit bigger, and then just add, like, a few more features to really make it something, and, like, this is basically everything I've ever wanted in a video game, which, that's really hard to do. Like, I feel like a lot of the time, like, this sort of game structure is kind of what I want to see going forward, applied to a lot of my favorite franchises. And I don't really want them to make it, like, the formula for every game, like they did with Ocarina, but I do want to see a lot of the things in Breath of the Wild implemented into other Nintendo franchises, for sure.
Yeah, I'd like to see what they do next with Zelda. Like, keep a lot of the base elements of Breath of the Wild, maybe, but then twist it in new ways and stuff. I don't know if having, like, the way they set this game up with the shrines, and, like, you don't really need to do any of them. You could, like, there's no real drive to, like, doing anything in the game. It's just sort of what you feel like doing. Which is, I think, some of the complaints are about the game, like, maybe, like, there's not enough complex dungeons, or, you know, you don't really have to do anything in particular. It's almost, like, open-ended. But, yeah, I don't know if they can pull off doing the exact same thing in the next game, like, setting it up with lots and lots of mini dungeons and shrines. I think they're going to have to... I think this is a one-and-done sort of thing. I don't know if they can pull off the exact same template again, like they kind of did with Ocarina of Time for, you know, the last 20 years.
Yeah.
They basically reused the bones of that game and, like, mixed it up and stuff. But what do you think about it? Like, would you want the shrine concept to reappear, or do you want something completely new?
So I liked the shrines.
Yeah, I don't get me wrong. I liked the shrines.
But yeah.
I don't know if setting up the next one would be for the best.
That's the thing. Like, what worked really well for them was, because they were trying to reinvent the wheel to some extent with this game, it worked really well because they were able to, within the confines of the story, say, okay, so here's, like, the layout for the dungeons, here's the layout for how you're going to level up, here's the layout for everything. And it works really well in this setting, but I agree with you that, like, the template, like, if they try using it again, it's going to be very difficult to try to just match that. I do want to see a lot of elements stay the same, but the shrines, I feel like I could go either way. I'm not actually one of the people who is, like, a huge dungeon defender. Like, as much as I do really love some of the dungeons and puzzles in older Zelda games, there's a few of them where I'm just like, you know, like they're a little...
Sometimes, it's a bit of a slog.
Yeah, sometimes, like, I feel like in Majora's Mask especially, as much as I adore that game, there's a few of the dungeons where I feel like, okay, well, this has slowed my progress down significantly, and I still want to play this game, but it kind of turns you off a little bit. Whereas this game, like, I felt like a lot of it was just common sense puzzles, which, as somebody who's more of, like, a left side brain thinker, I could really appreciate that, because I'm like, oh, okay, well, this would make sense for me. But also what I appreciated was how there was multiple solutions to finish the dungeons, which really, helped a lot, because I'm like, okay, well, if I get stuck, like, let me try a different way, and then normally, like, a different way would work. And it really just, it was really satisfying. It just, in an age where, like, you know, you play a game, like, and I liked there to be somewhat of a point to it. Like, it just felt like a really good, like, mental brain puzzle or brain teaser just to, like, beat one of the shrines and say, oh, yeah, I figured that out because, and then, you know, you ask somebody else, hey, what'd you do? And then somebody's like, oh, you know, I just decided to, you know, change it. I did it this way, and it's completely, two completely different ways, which I found fascinating.
Yeah, I really liked how you could sort of just do, like, work out different puzzles and stuff with the shrines and sort of even bypass whole sections if you're sort of in like clever enough to think of something. Cause like back when I was like, yeah, playing Ocarina and like sort of learning what the Zelda, you know, puzzle solving was, I would try things that would like should work in real life. And then like, it didn't work in the game, but in this game that sort of thinking paid off a bit more. Like you could actually think outside the box a bit and, yeah, just do stuff that would probably work in reality to a degree.
Exactly. That's one of the things. I used to do the same thing when I would play Ocarina. And it always kind of... You know, when you're playing video games, you already have, like, a sense of... like, a suspension of disbelief. But, you know, playing a game as smart as the Zelda series, it always kind of bugged me just a little bit that the obvious thing to do in real life isn't the obvious answer in the game, which kind of like it was good for the first, you know, like however many years of them in the series. But once it got to like Twilight Princess, I think was when I started thinking, okay, well, the more realistic, you know, these games are getting, the harder it is to suspend my disbelief of, oh, I couldn't like, you know, like I'm trying to, you know, I'm racking my brain to think of an example, but just some of the ways that you can
even use... just climbing over stuff.
Like, yeah, exactly.
You know, some of the way the dungeon is set up in Zelda games, you could, like, if in real life, Link would just, like, climb up that wall and jump over that fence and it's done, and done, you know, like...
Exactly.
Yeah.
No, for sure. Speaking of which, jumping and climbing, those are two of my favorite mechanics in the game, which sounds really weird for something that has been around for as long as, like, you know, the NES and earlier, but, like, jumping off of, like, a giant cliff and paragliding into, like, a giant, like, rock wall and then starting to climb up it is one of my favorite experiences. It's just a great loop where I would get in the habit of it. Just being able to climb anything is a complete game changer for me. Because like, I never knew I wanted that in a game, but now that I've played it, I'm like, I absolutely adore this mechanic and I just want it to show up in more games. Cause it adds a lot to the experience and it sort
towards
of makes
the end of my towards the end of my playthrough, I was getting a little like, wasn't as enamored with climbing as I was near the beginning of the game, but, I really liked climbing early on because it was like a bit of a puzzle trying to, you looked at a mountain and you're like, I wonder if I could stretch my stamina meter enough to get to that section there. And I really liked that sort of looking at something and sort of trying to judge and try and see if you can pull off a certain climb. I thought that was really fun.
Yeah, no, for sure. Cause then you start, the thing that I really appreciated about it was that it like made me not want to fast travel as much. Because which really lent itself well to the exploration. Cause I could go to, you know, climb to a huge cliff and, you know, 9 times out of 10, there would be something up there. And even if there wasn't something up there, there was probably at least a good enough of a vantage point that I could look off, to see where I would go next. Which really helped because I was like, oh, cool. Like I remember going shrine hunting, to try to get, enough hearts for the Master Sword. And I got to a point where I was like, oh man, like where in the world are these shrines? And I would sometimes climb to like the tallest mountain and I'd be like, okay, well, I don't see anything. And then I'd see like a small orange glowing dot in the distance. And I'm like, well, I know where I'm going. And then I just jump off the cliff. I would just go like fly towards the orange dot. And then like, you know, of course something else would happen along the way, but I would get so, entranced in the idea of, oh man, I wonder what else is out there. If I just climb enough of these things. Yeah, but it was just really, like, the game just really took me by surprise with a lot of the bold choices it made. One of the choices it made that I'll be honest, I thought I was going to hate it, and I actually didn't, was the weapon degrading system. However,
breaking, yeah.
Yeah, just the way, however you say that. Just the weapons breaking. I really, really hate it when a weapon breaks in a video game. just because it feels like, what was the purpose of it breaking? Because, like, I enjoyed using it, and now I can't use it. But in this, yeah, it's done so smart that I didn't feel bad about it. And the way the Great Plateau is laid out really lends itself well to, hey, you know, you've got a few items laying around here if you run out of a weapon or you decide to act stupidly with your weapons, to really kind of, like, you know, teach you how to work with the system. But I really actually enjoyed being able to, being forced to use different weapons I would never, ever touch.
Yeah, I thought, that, like, I wouldn't like the breaking of the weapons as well, because I kind of, yeah, similar thoughts. I get sort of annoyed at it sometimes in other games, but I think if only becomes annoying, like, in this game, I was like, okay, I'm just not going to worry about it. Just, you got to make that decision at the start, like, early on, just to be like, don't worry about them breaking. There's always more.
Totally.
There's always more out there. And I think the people that, like, because I could have easily fallen into the other camp where I was like, yeah, some people like tried to hoard their more powerful weapons for later, and then you just never end up using them. Like, you're just holding them for no real reason. I think, yeah, like, the people that were doing that weren't having as good a time with it, and that's the people that had a more negative view on the breaking system, I think. Because I think, yeah, you have to just embrace it to get the most out of it and to, like, sort of have the most fun with the game, because, yeah, I don't like having to worry about, you know, oh, I might use this later on, or I might need this later on, sort of thing. Especially because, like, yeah, in the game, you can just, there's nothing you can't re-get. They're always going to respawn.
Like, yeah. It's
enough of everything, yeah.
Exactly. And that's kind of the thing I kept telling myself is, you know, no matter how much it would bug me, like, as long as I just wouldn't think about it and I would just use what I had, it actually kind of taught me how to use my inventory system a lot more. Because in an RPG, I normally find myself saving whatever big, whatever, like, big grand weapons or items I have and never wanting to use them, or sometimes being afraid to sell them. And in this game, it kind of, like, just broke me. It's like, hey, it's okay. Like, go ahead and, you know, sell these items that you think are valuable, or, you know, that you think you need to hold on to. Go ahead and sell them, or go ahead and use that giant weapon that you got, like, you know, 30 shrines ago, and go ahead and try and use it. Like, it worked really, really well. And once you start finding out that, you know, there's certain enemies that are weaker against certain weapons, and the way you start, like, working together with what you have, it worked out really, really well. And just knowing that you had, you know, you always have a tool to take care of an enemy, whether it be, like, the bombs, or whether it be, like, just the multiple, like, slots that you could unlock for your bows and arrows. Everything just felt really, really smartly designed when it came down to it, which I really enjoyed that.
The only thing in the game I'm not as, like, super keen on is, like, the story. I was, like, from the initial trailers, they made the story seem like it might have been more interesting or had something a bit more to it than the... It's pretty, like, straightforward, really. It's pretty much conventional Zelda story, except, like, delayed by 100 years. Like, they kind of failed and then had to come back and beat it again, basically, but... I don't know.
Yeah, like, that's fair.
What do you think?
So, initially, I was worried about that, because, like, watching the trailer, I definitely got the same vibe you did. Like, oh my goodness, this is going to be such a well-told story. And I thought it was going to be structured differently. And so once I probably would, I'd say once I, like, went the first time to Ganon just to kind of see what was up, and I started realizing, like, oh, this is how this is going to play out. I don't know if I was bothered by it or if I was like, oh, thank goodness. Because, like, it's a little bit of both for me. Because I love Zelda's story. But sometimes I feel as if its story also is sometimes the thing that bogs it down. Not necessarily that it makes it a slog to get through, but sometimes it makes it feel sort of slow. So, like, in the beginning, going back to Twilight Princess, and I promise I do like Twilight Princess, I keep bringing it up as my reference point, because that's the one that kind of started making me feel this way towards Zelda. But the opening for that game, as many know, is very kind of kind of a sludge. And once you get going in the game, it's very good, but it feels very bogged down because of that opening. And it just feels like it has a lot of unnecessary elements. And even though it's teaching you, you know, elements later for the game, I thought this was just a much more slick way of like, hey, like the first hour is you getting your paraglider and learning how to do a dungeon or shrine rather. And once you learn all these things on the Great Plateau, go for it. Like, everything is yours. And it, like, the most it took me was probably, like, an hour. And then after that, everything was free game. But, yeah, like...
See, I don't have a problem with, like... I really liked how it opened up and you were playing from the start. Like, that's a good thing. Like, I got sort of... Yeah, Skyward Sword and Twilight Princess had that really long story stuff at the beginning and it was kind of boring. But, yeah, that's not really the thing I have an issue with. It's just, like, the content of the story. Like, they could have set it up exactly the same, but made it a bit more, like, some of the story more interesting or...
Yeah.
Like, some more twists or something. I don't know. I don't know exactly what, but, like...
I do know...
Make it a little bit more different.
Yeah. The one, I would say, if I had to, like, nitpick at all on the story, I think... So, Majora's Mask was previously my favorite Zelda, and it was because, like, primarily for the story, because I found the world and the lore of the game to be so interesting. The idea that there are these giant, you know, beings that, you know, like, and the whole theory is that it's about, like, the stages of grief and everything. It's just got much more rich history to it. So I do agree that even though, like, this definitely had, like, some rich history, I feel like it did a lot more showing than it did telling. Which worked in, you know, it worked in some ways, but it didn't always pay off in others. I did find the flashbacks to be very, appealing. Although the one thing I do think it could have used is it probably could have had better ways to funnel you down the path to find those. Cause like by the time that I was getting ready to go fight Ganon, I knew I was going to collect those first. Cause there are two, like there's an additional ending you get if you find those. And I, in all honesty, I just kind of looked them up because I was like, well, I'm not going to, you know, I'm not going to waste another hour trying to find these. I'll just look them up and, you know, go from there. Because I want to beat Ganon. I want to beat this game, you know, soon. But yeah, I feel like they could have done a little bit of a better job, managing you like, hey, here's how you can get to the story just a little bit easier. Here's a little bit more story for you. But overall, I didn't find it too jarring. I still felt like it was good enough to where, as somebody who enjoys Souls games as well, I'm kind of okay with a little bit more of a storytelling from visual perspective rather than, hey, here's a cutscene to show you what happened.
Yeah. I mean, like, there's a lot of interesting monuments and buildings in the world that hint at the greater history of Hyrule. And, like, you could probably walk around and look at each one and, like, sort of try and decipher, like, exactly what that means or whatever. That's cool.
Yeah.
But,
no, for sure.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, the cutscenes and stuff, probably, I don't know. Some of them were quite good. Some of them were a bit short and sort of, eh. I did like hunting down the memories, though, because, like, I would look at the picture and be like, I sort of know where that is. And then I would go to that area and look around the landscape and try and find that exact angle from the picture, and then, like, I tracked most of them down like that, but then the last few, I just, like, looked up where they were, because I was like, I don't really want to wander around for another 3 hours trying to find
these
last few. But,
good to know.
Another thing that could have been interesting would be, instead of, like, just a cutscene at those spots, you were transported back, and you could control Link back in that time period and sort of do a short section within that. Like, you might have to do like a little, I don't know, say mission, and then like it ends with like that cutscene sort of thing. Like, it led up to the cutscene. You walked around and like interacted with people in the world and stuff in sort of a limited way.
Yeah, I agree. There could have been a little bit smarter implementation of, oh, that's right, I remember. Like, the few times I thought it worked okay, like, if it was, like, a very critical story beat, like, the one I think that stands out the most to me is probably the one with Link and Zelda in the forest when they're running from some of the Guardians, and then also the one where they're she comes back from like Mount Lanayru, and they're all standing around talking about it, and that's exactly when Calamity Ganon hits, and they all have to like really quickly make haste. Like, those were the ones where I was like, oh my goodness, yes, this is exactly what I would want out of these cutscenes. Because in a game that has minimal cutscenes, I want the cutscenes that it has to be impactful and to be something that is like large, like it affects me as a player, where I can go, oh, I can totally see why this should have an emotional an impact, and it should affect like my gameplay up to this point. A couple games that do that really well is like Metal Gear Solid 5, The Phantom Pain, or Bloodborne. Every time I would get a cutscene in any of those games, I'm like, oh, okay, so that means that something like this is a culmination of all the things I've done up to this point. Whereas with this, like, a few of the cutscenes I get were kind of just to flesh out the characters, but every once in a while I would question, like, oh, okay, well, I don't know why that was meant to be, like, a memory that Link would hold on to, like, super well. Like, the frog one, specifically, I thought was cute, but there was times where I was like, as a player, like, the emotional impact of that scene doesn't quite get me as much as something like, you know, Calamity Ganon striking when she comes back from Mount Lanayru. Like, some of those scenes, I was just like, okay, well, I get the purpose of it, but I don't find it always, like, I didn't find everyone paid off, but a good few of them I thought were okay. But yeah, like, as far as, like, my overall feel on the game, like, I could not be more impressed with it. Just the amount of freedom that Nintendo decided to allow the player with this whole experience was just really surprising to me. I didn't expect them, and I didn't really expect any developer at any point to try and accomplish a game where they say, like, we're not worried about the sequence in which you do things, we're not worried about what you climb on, we're not worried about, like, any, like, they basically gave you no boundaries outside of in the shrines, being able to, like, not climb on them to break the puzzles. Like, the entire thing was completely free, and as a player, that's really, really empowering, knowing that the developer of the game trusts you enough to go ahead and play the game however you desire. That's really, really cool. So I was overall, like, blown away with the game.
And you're excited for the DLC then?
Oh, absolutely. I don't think I bought it the first week it came out, but, like, within the following weeks, I did purchase it. And I'm slowly tracking down all of the costumes. As far as the DLC, I'm really hoping it fleshes out the story more. Because as we discussed with the story, like, I wanted to see a few more, you know, emotionally impactful scenes. I also felt like the final boss, Dark Beast Ganon, I felt like even though it was a really, really nice, like, big epic moment, like, the way in which you beat him and then the way in which it ends, it feels just a tad bit flatter than maybe I would have expected. So I'm really kind of hoping that, like, if the DLC, I assume the DLC is going to take place, like, during the time of the champions, with it being called the Champions Ballad. So I'm really hoping that.
No, I think it's like, I don't know. I guess there's a connection to the champions, but, like, isn't it set after the game? It's set after the end of the game.
Oh, okay. I did not, like, know that.
Yeah. So
cool. So I don't know. That gives me a more hope then that they'll kind of flesh out some more of what they'll plan on doing after, because that feels kind of like, even with the scene that you get at the end after you get all the photos, it kind of felt like, okay, cool. So I got all these photos for her to tell Link that, oh, yep, it's time to go remake everything in Hyrule and fix everything. So that, yeah. I mean, it's definitely not a bad ending. I just felt like it was standard. It was definitely what I expected from, you know, from an ending like that. But, I mean, the game is about the journey. So I definitely would agree that the journey, I would say that the journey was definitely worth taking, more so than even just seeing the ending. But yeah, no, I'm definitely excited about the DLC.
All right, then. I guess we'll leave it there. I think we've chatted a fair bit about your thoughts and general more Zelda stuff that, you know, has been spoken about to death on everywhere else on the internet, but it's always good to come back and have a chat about Zelda again, because, like, I haven't touched the game for ages now, and I did dabble in, like, I played a little bit of it again when the DLC came out, and I felt kind of I needed to get back into it, because I felt really sloppy on, like, how to play the game again, like, the controls and, like, shooting, taking out enemies and stuff. I was like, oh, okay, I'm not sort of my muscle memory wasn't good enough to overcome, like, compensate enough, I guess. But
just walk up to a Lionel and just instantly, it just gets
yeah,
you.
I'm going to have to, like, practice again, because, like, I need to try and beat that Trials, the Master
yeah.
Trials at some point.
I still got to go around to getting to doing that, because that's definitely something I want to accomplish before it gets too late in the year. I want to try to do that.
Okay, well, thanks, Kelton, for having a chat, and we'll be hopefully back with another episode in a couple of weeks, everyone, so stay tuned for that, and as always, if you have any questions or comments, please send them to connectivity@nintendoworldreport.com. Alright then, bye everyone.
Bye-bye.
Welcome to a Connectivity bonus segment. We haven't had one of these since I took over running Connectivity, actually. So we're bringing it back with a classic Doctor Who episode, and today I'm Nicholas Bray, and today I'm joined by Amanda Albert.
Hello!
And Mike Sklens.
Hey, I'm back on Connectivity.
You're back. You should come on more often.
Maybe I will.
Ask me to come on. Yeah. So today, we're going to talk about the latest season of Doctor Who, which finished up like a couple of weeks ago. So I don't really know where to start, but I guess we should maybe just start, you know, at the beginning of the season and our general thoughts on the new companion, at least, Bill Potts.
Yeah.
What do you guys think of Bill Potts?
I like her eyebrows.
I like everything about Bill. I think she's very refreshing on the show, and she's like wide-eyed and exciting and just funny, and I don't know, I like her a lot.
Yeah,
yeah, I think she's the... Oh, sorry.
No, go for it.
I was just going to say, I think she's the companion of, like, the most, like, for a while now. She sort of, yeah, was fun right away.
Yeah, she had a definite personality.
Mm.
Yeah, there was almost no, like, breaking in her character. It just felt like she fit right away.
Mm-hmm.
It was really good.
Good chemistry.
This whole, some of the early parts of this season reminded me a bit of sort of the structure of the first season of the new show. Like, it seemed like Moffat might have been sort of mimicking RTD a little bit at the start there.
Do you think it's because they
the companion and?
Do you think it's because they did a Victorian episode in the third one?
And they did a future episode in the second one too.
Yeah.
Yeah, I felt like Russell T a lot. To me, towards the beginning especially, there's a lot of...
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
We watched the episode earlier tonight where it's the monster under the ice, and that just feels like a Russell T. episode all the way through.
In the good way.
So, the first episode, it was like this weird puddle episode. It was like a conscious...
Yeah, that one was weird.
Puddle? The pilot? What was that exactly?
Gack.
So that sort of set up. I liked how that like set up the end as well for the whole series. I know that's skipping ahead, but like the first episode and the last episode are linked by what happened in the first episode with the girl getting turned into like this. I don't know. I can't really remember how,
like, nanomachines or
what,
something.
Was she, right?
Oh, who cares?
I think she was like nanomachines that could repair the ship. And they were sentient.
Sounds right.
That was a really weird concept. I don't think I fully understood it.
I didn't. Long as they could explain it, that's fine. Good enough. It's not going to be memorable enough, obviously.
What was your favorite episode of the season then?
Thin Ice, probably. I like that a lot. That three-part arc just killed me. So.
Yeah, I was going to say the sort of the loose three-parter.
I really like Oxygen.
I could not give a shit less.
I thought Oxygen was great. Really clever twist at the end with the Doctor going blind, and then it kind of like reverberates a bit for the next couple episodes. Even though that three-part arc with the monks was, I think, the worst part of the season.
It is garbage. It's just like, how is it? How bad does it have to be if the whole world is ending, and I couldn't care like what was happening in those episodes? It was just, I know things are happening, but it wasn't terribly interesting. As much as I like the characters.
Yeah. Yeah, there's some good moments with Nuddle and
yeah, stuff, there's a few funny bits.
Three episodes were, yeah, I thought those three episodes were kind of boring, really. You know, I was looking forward to seeing a three-parter in the new series, and it was like kind of,
yeah, I thought the first part was good.
I don't think I wanted
it. It reminded me of when you were, it took me back to watching like a old Peter Davison one where it drags on and on and on, and you can't even remember how it started.
I thought the third part was all right, but the middle part was, like, just bad. I just really didn't like the middle part at all.
And then after that, we saw the return of the Ice Warriors.
What was your favorite?
Interesting. Oh, my favorite. it's got to have to be the final two-parter. I think that was easily the best two episodes in the season.
Yeah, they're really fun. Yeah.
It's an easy choice, but I really like
it. It's an easy choice, but it's a good choice.
I think that's the best Cyberman story they've ever done.
You think so?
Like,
it's pretty fun. I really enjoyed it.
In like part one where they're creating the Cyberman, I thought that was a really good origin story.
Yeah. And I just love them bringing back the old costume, and somehow they've still managed to make it look good, as hokey as it is. And I'm a sucker for those old ones, you know?
Like those Mondasian Cybermen?
Yeah.
Yeah. Is that what charmed you?
Yeah, I really like the design of them. And I think I think they could have come off really bad.
You're so right, yes.
If they just started off, throwing the Cybermen right into the story, but they sort of justified it by showing the gradual change that the people were going through.
Yeah.
In the hospital and stuff. So it was more creepy that
way. And it canonizes all the older stuff, too. Like, that's always what I think is the best parts of the show, is when they're doing something new, but they're still tying it back to all the previous history of the show.
Mm-hmm. And Peter Capaldi, like, wanted the old Cybermen in the story.
Oh, I didn't know that!
He sort of got his wish. Yeah, the last couple of years, he's been saying, like, poking Moffat to say, oh, bring back the original Cybermen, and so I guess Moffat just did it for
him. Such a good idea.
Because it was his last season. Yeah. As for the worst episode, I thought it was that the Eaters of Light episode set in Scotland.
Eaters of Light. I can't even remember which one this is. You told me this earlier,
Mike.
With the
handsome Roman soldier.
Yeah, that's right. There's a good looking one. It wasn't bad. I hate multi-parters generally, but so that kind of clouds my judgment. I can't remember what the hell was.
Well, that wasn't a multi-parter.
But I'm saying it clouds my judgment a little bit because I'm blindsided by my hatred for the multi-parters typically. But yeah, I wouldn't say that's one of the strong ones.
Yeah, I thought Eaters of Light was all right. Like, it was kind of Monster of the Week. It was good, but.
Well, there I like a Monster of a episodes. Week episode.
The Ice Warriors, that was Monster of the Week, and I really liked that one. And so was Thin Ice.
Yeah, I really liked that one, too.
I think what annoyed me about that one, though, is that I always want them to address certain things, and I know that show survives on being, like, ambiguous, but when you see them there in Rome, you kind of want them, since it's Capaldi's last season, to kind of make some kind of reference to where he got his face or something. And they
weren't in Rome.
Weren't they in Rome?
No, it was Scotland. It was Roman soldiers in Scotland.
Yeah, but I'm saying Roman soldiers in Scotland. They could have still had some kind of reference or reason. You know what I mean?
Well, yeah, that's like him all over, isn't it? Because it's got the Roman connection.
Yes, that's
Scottish,
what I'm saying.
So.
It would have been, it's like, look, for me, it was like a remissed opportunity.
Yeah, I could at least put, like, a little joke in there or something.
Something. I can't help but associate it with that, with the Roman time, because that's where we first saw him.
I think my least favorite was whatever the middle of that three-parter was. I can't even remember the name of it. It was not. It was just, I don't ever want to see it again.
It was The Pyramid at the End of the
World. Yeah. Not,
that, not that's good. A terrible title. Do we like this show?
I really like this show. This season was super good. Every season has bad episodes. This one only had one truly bad episode, and then it had its ups and its downs, but it had a lot of ups.
I'm glad he kind of knocked it off with the overcomplicated shit.
Yeah, he used to do those ones where, like, if we don't solve this problem, the whole universe is destroyed. And I got real tired of that with Moffat. Like, he couldn't stop raising the stakes.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like he reined himself in a lot this season, and it showed a lot, and it was a huge benefit to the show.
And I like Capaldi being a professor. That works really well, I think, for him.
They kind of just, like, abandoned the whole vault thing, though, like, near, towards the end, just sort of like, oh yeah, Missy's out now, so
fuck it.
Yeah, it was just like a ticking clock, like, you know something's coming, but then there's no repercussions when it comes at all.
Yeah.
I thought having Missy in the vault was a little bit like, everyone sort of guessed that already, and it was kind of a bit, I don't know, boring, I guess. It would have been maybe more interesting if it was the Sim Master inside the vault instead of
him. That's what I thought it was going to be, because I knew he was going to be in this season. Yes. And then there's an episode where, like, she's knocking on the door, and I was like, no, they should be knocking four times.
Do you remember how I used to say everything was the Master?
This time
I was finally right.
You were.
He was dedicated to trying to screw the Doctor over in the two-parter.
Or trying to screw him.
He waited like 10 years or more just to do that in disguise.
He was in that whole disguise just to fuck with the Doctor. That was
and
great.
And that terrible accent. Yeah.
So evil.
I love the reveal because it was a lot of like, the Master used to dress up all the time.
Yes! Years,
and then like in this one he pulled the face off and then they zoomed the camera in on his face.
Like it was like a bad soap opera. It was so good. Like, doesn't he do that in, one of my, it's not one of my favorites because it's good. It's one of my favorites because it's so of its time. It's the Peter Davison one where they're on the Concorde.
Oh, yeah, Time Flight, yeah.
Yes! Of course you know the title. Mm-hmm. This is why I like you. And, doesn't the Master do it there? And isn't he pretending to be some, like, Chinese guy the whole time?
I don't actually remember because I haven't really watched that one. That much.
You're not missing a lot.
Yeah, no. I sort of don't like the, towards the end of the 80s of Doctor Who. I just don't like it, really.
Why?
I don't know. The production values, just the actors, the stories, that it's not as good. That
the soundtrack?
Just everything.
Just everything, pretty much.
Yeah. Adric.
Adric.
Oh, fuck Adric. I hate Adric, you guys. I'm so happy when he got blown up and he killed all the dinosaurs. That was my favorite episode.
Do you know the plot of what Adric's story is?
Sorry?
Hello? Do you know the plot point of Adric's life in that show?
The plot point? What?
Like, do you know his... Are you familiar with the character Adric?
Yeah.
Do you know his story?
Know what?
Like his arc?
I know he dies and stuff, but, like, he doesn't really have an arc. He's just sort of annoying and then dies.
Yeah. Yes, I agree completely. But I just...
that's his arc. And he kills all the dinosaurs.
Yeah, that's what we always say. What an asshole. He killed all the dinosaurs.
And then he died, so he got what he deserved.
There was actually...
I hate Adric.
This is getting off topic, but, like, ages ago, I saw someone's, like, claymation, sequel to Adric crashing onto the planet Earth. And, like, Adric survives and then just gets eaten by a dinosaur.
Yes,
getting off topic, but well worth it, I say.
This is now the fuck Adric cast. God, I hate him.
But going back to the Master, it was really good to have John Sim have another crack at it and sort of redeem himself. Like,
yeah.
His last appearance isn't that story where he's sort of crazy and silly.
Oh, you didn't like him in the pumps and the skirt?
Oh, is that the one where he's like, he becomes everyone on the planet?
Yeah.
Yeah, and then yeah, at the end of the episode, he goes back to Gallifrey with Rassilon and stuff.
Yeah, it was really cool to see him come back and just kind of, like, cheese it up enough, but then also be, like, really, really evil. Like, he's way more evil than Missy. Like, way more.
Yeah, because, like, Missy...
And that's kind of, I think, the whole point of it, is, like, the struggle of identity between Missy and John Sims' master, where he, like, he's just complete, like, chaotic evil, and she's drifting more towards chaotic neutral in a way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I liked how, you know, at the end of the story, basically for the Masters, that, you know, the Doctor did have an influence. He did change Missy's, like, personality and made her, you know, choose to be good, I guess, sort of.
There is some hope!
There's some hope, but then she dies. So, maybe. Who knows?
Who do you want to be the new Doctor?
I have no idea. Someone interesting. I couldn't deal with...
Yes.
With a boring, another sort of boring choice. I really don't like the idea of that guy from Death in Paradise being the new Doctor that was going around.
I agree! Long. Nope.
I mean, he can do it well enough, but it's just be the same as
get
the
somebody
others.
More dynamic, though. I want something I haven't seen.
Mm.
Like, I always say, want Richard Ayoade.
I don't know who that is.
You don't know who that is? You should know you're Australian. You have more access to the BBC than I do.
I don't watch that much.
He's
TV.
On a only Doctor Who.
Pretty much.
He's on the IT Crowd. Is probably what you would have seen him in. He's Moss, Maurice Moss.
I haven't watched that show, so.
What about?
Watch a bunch of British chat shows.
What about the, is it the Crystal Palace, Mike?
Oh, the Crystal Maze, but that just started airing like a week ago.
Oh. Well, that's really good anyways. You should watch it.
What do you think the likelihood of it being like a female Doctor this time? I think they were heavily hinting at it towards the end of the season.
I think they were too.
Didn't they already, like, kind of say who it was? I mean, not completely, but the word on the street.
Fresh meat,
there was that
right?
rumor
yeah.
down, there was that girl that woman that might be rumored to be the Doctor, right?
Wait. Let's do our research here. We can do something, right? We can Google this.
I do find it strange that they haven't sort of announced it yet, though. Like, usually we'll know by now.
Yeah, I felt like that, too.
They had that big TV special where they're like, here's the new Doctor.
And then that kind of
just
fell on its face because everyone was like, oh, no, I hate him.
Yeah,
even though he's fantastic,
yeah,
Phoebe,
and he's like the best Doctor they've had since the reboot.
So good.
I got the name. It's Phoebe Waller-Bridge.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, I have no idea how good she would be or anything, but I guess it'd be an interesting.
Well, you don't watch TV. I like her in the other things I've seen. I think she's to me. I always am like, okay, can they be funny? Can they be kind of eccentric and like weird and scary? And then can they, like, do a good monologue?
Yeah.
And I think she could do those things, so that's fine enough by me. I've kind of tried to let go of all my preconceived notions at this point, because I've been wrong before.
It'll probably just be someone we've never heard of before. It'll just be some random new person.
Like a new Matt Smith?
Yeah.
Like a totally unknown? Yep.
Just
turned out great last time.
Just not freaking milquetoast, please.
I don't think we'll ever get a milquetoast Doctor.
Duh.
Have we had one yet?
Yeah.
Since the reboot?
So since the reboot? No, I don't think so.
Yeah, they've all been good. I think they'll do a good job.
I hope. We'll see. It's just, I don't ever think they'll pick somebody terrible. It's just sometimes you're so annoyed with the choice because of all the opportunity that they could have had to get something more compelling.
Yeah, I try not to stay invested in it and just kind of, you know, I'll wait and see who it is. Like, I don't want to get my hopes up for anybody because then I'll just
That's fun! It's fun to be let down.
You know, even if, like, the initial reaction is like, oh, they chose that person. I always like give them a good chance to, you know.
Oh, yeah.
They'll
yeah.
probably be pretty good no matter who it is. So it's not usually a big deal, but.
Yeah, they're not going to cast a bad actor.
But I don't want that other guy.
Sorry?
But I don't want that one guy.
I'm more excited about Chris Chibnall taking over, because I'm just interested
yes!
to see like a new take on Doctor Who, and I wonder if it's going to get really dark or anything, because Broadchurch
was It'll
really
never
dark.
Get really dark, because it's still a show for kids as well. I mean, they can only go so far.
Yeah.
What did you guys think of the first Doctor showing up, though, at the end?
That's going to be fun.
I'm so excited. That's yeah. so cool to have David Bradley come back to replay the first Doctor. That was, they were kind of hinting at it.
Yeah.
And then Amanda and I looked at each other and we were like, oh, what's happening? And then he yeah. came out and we both like freaked out.
Cause I'd read rumors, like people were saying, oh, the first Doctor's going to show up at the end and the Christmas special. And I was like, oh yeah, that's a nice rumor, but I kind of, I don't know. I don't see it maybe happening cause it's usually too good to be true, those sort of things. And then they actually mm-hmm. did it. So. It's interesting that it looks like Capaldi showed up maybe in the story The Tenth Planet, like the last story for the First Doctor. That's where he regenerates in that story.
Mm.
And he's like mm. mysteriously just like gets sick for two episodes in that story because William Hartnell.
Oh, yeah.
William Hartnell was actually sick or something. So they sort of wrote yeah. him out of the story. But now they might be like, oh, he was like faking it and he's going out to help a future doctor. That'd be funny.
Love it.
Oh, that'd be so a really good. Clever way to like retcon a whole yeah. plot into the yeah. first doctor.
Yeah. See, and that's what it does. Yeah, and that's what it does, man, when it's at its best, is it's linking it up.
Mm.
That's some Moffat shit, too. Like, he would totally do that.
Oh, he would. And then he would totally congratulate himself.
The snowy place where the TARDIS has landed looks like, you know, the place was snowy in the original story too, so it could be. And it was a Cyberman story as well, so.
Ooh. See, you got the inside baseball, you know.
Alright, we gotta find this episode and watch it now.
I think I've
watched. The Tenth Planet?
I have watched some at your recommendation of the first Doctor, and they've been pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I can't remember what ones I suggested, so.
You told me to watch The Escape.
Oh, yep.
I think you told me that was one of your favorite ones, and I thought it was really good.
Hmm. I think I suggested The Aztecs as well, maybe.
Yeah, which I enjoyed also.
That one's good.
That would be so fun to see them do something in that kind of environment again with today's budget. It would look so good.
Yeah. And then they've got the costumes for the 60s Cybermen, so if they wanted to like mingle into that story even more, they could.
Yeah.
Oh, I really hope this happens.
Yeah.
So what else is there? Did you guys like Nardole? I thought he was pretty funny throughout the whole season.
I like Nardole.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. I think it's really good when the Doctor has two companions.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Because it lets them play off each other and it lets them do different things. And I thought Nardole was really cool because he's like he's kind of a babysitter for the Doctor, but then also like he's really funny and witty. Like Matt Lucas is great in yeah. anything usually, so it was really cool to just have him on set.
He reminded me of Nurse Ratched a bit with the Doctor, which is kind of what he needs, honestly.
I kind of liked the dynamic because all the other male companions, maybe like except Captain Jack, that they've had they're sort of like second fiddle to the female companion. They already know the Doctor through the female companion, and this time it was sort of
mm-hmm.
Nardole was separated from Bill, like he was his mm-hmm. own thing and not just connected mm-hmm. through someone.
Yeah.
He's not even human. He's like a robot,
yeah,
right?
He's like an android thing, isn't he?
Yeah.
But I also like it because for what you just mentioned, he kind of doesn't take any shit from the Doctor.
Yeah.
Which usually they're kind of also beta males.
Mm.
And plus, it also, because he's like an android with like lots of alien knowledge, it lets them use him as exposition a lot so the Doctor doesn't need to explain fucking everything.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it's nice that Nardole can just kind of slide background info in there and like help flesh out the plot, and it's not all running on the shoulders of the Doctor, like being a know-it-all.
Yeah. Yeah, I hadn't really thought of that before, but yeah, you're right. It's like, it helped a bit to make it feel a bit different, maybe.
We get deep about Doctor Who.
Yeah, listeners all do different things. So what did you guys think of the Doctor going blind? Because that's like a big part of this season. That's like almost a quarter of the episodes he's blind.
The season, man.
When he went blind, I thought he was going to be blind for the rest of the season because they know this is his last season anyway, so let's just do something crazy and make him blind for all of it.
Yep.
And then he got his sight back like four episodes later. But still, I thought it was a really cool like subplot where he goes through and he's blind and it changes the dynamic of what he can do and how he can act. And he's trying to keep it secret from Bill the whole time. You know, he's lying to her and telling her, "Oh no, I can see fine." Mm-hmm. Plus, it lets him wear the sunglasses and he looks really good in them. So I really liked it. I thought it was a really daring direction to move the show in. I just kind of wish that it lasts the whole season.
Yeah, I was surprised that they, like, when it happened, I was actually surprised, and I thought, oh, wow, that's something new. Like, I kind of expected it just to be made okay at the end of the episode, like usual.
Yeah, me too. Yeah. And then they twist it, and they're like, no, this is a lasting consequence.
Yeah.
Aha.
And I think it would, I agree, it would have been interesting if he had to deal with it for the entire rest of the season. And, or even, like, because when Moffat took over, he toyed with the idea of having the Doctor, like, be regenerating throughout the entire season, slowly, like he's succumbing to the effects or something. And I thought that might have been, like, where he was maybe taking it with the eyesight thing. Like, he's going to injure the Doctor and then, like, you know, he'll regenerate at the end and be all good again. But, it was kind of a bit of a cop-out that he just got it fixed, but...
Yeah, I like it when they actually have stronger consequences. It makes you way more invested.
Mm.
Yeah, but it was still nice to get it, even for a little bit, to see something like really drastically different on the show.
Yeah, whenever the Doctor has got to be vulnerable, it's pretty compelling.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, that's it. It makes it much more vulnerable.
Did you, I sort of knew that Bill was going to leave at the end of the season already, but... I don't know, it was kind of, when she got transformed into a Cyberman, he was like, oh, damn, they went all the way and, like, killed her, basically.
Yeah.
That was another thing where it's like, consequences! Ha, the Doctor's, like, had his companion turned into a Cyberman. Like, this is maybe the worst thing that's ever happened to one of his companions.
Aside from
that,
but
then they kind of, like, they deus ex machina in it, literally with, the nano gel lady or whatever. She's a machine, so... She literally comes in and saves the day.
Well,
like,
then
oh,
they went to go live in
went to go be space wives.
No, what is it from the Black Mirror?
Oh, San Junipero.
Yeah, they went to San Junipero. It's a nice place. It's great this time of year. Do you know Black Mirror, Nick? You don't watch TV.
No, I know what it is, but I haven't watched it.
There's a great episode having to do with a virtual reality.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
That's really good. It's called San Junipero.
Okay.
Well, see, there are some episodes we didn't
talk
about.
If you watch
it,
what
did you guys
then
think
you
of,
can laugh at how appropriate the comparison is.
Yeah.
I hope they don't... I kind of hope they don't bring her back for the towards the end of the Christmas special or something, because the pilot said, oh, yeah, I could just make you human again and you'd be fine, but...
Oh, shit. Yeah, you're right. They better not.
Yeah.
I think it was one of those things where, like, we don't know if Pearl Mackey's going to sign her contract. So, question mark.
I think they're going to not, like, she won't be in next season. They'll have a blank slate next year, I think.
Yeah. That'll
be
exciting.
If they go with a lady doctor, they'll probably have a male companion, right?
Maybe. Who knows?
You think what is that supposed to mean, Mike?
Sense, probably, but... But then you could have you could have like multiple companions again, I guess. That might be a better way to do it.
I like
what if you
companions?
Had two ladies in space? I do like the multiple companions. I feel like whenever he has to it works good for him wanting to manipulate them, which works well for plots.
Mm.
Do you know what I mean? Like if the two companions are bickering.
Yeah.
He can choose whether or not he uses that to his advantage.
Yeah, well, it's a lot easier to have a B plot when you've got three characters.
Right.
It's really hard to have two plots when you have two characters.
Yes.
So.
They could have, bring back sort of the Dr. Jamie sort of relationship.
Oh, Amanda would be so happy if they brought Jamie back. Amanda loves Jamie.
Yeah. We've been watching Outlander, and I can totally see how that was a Doctor Who fanfiction originally. Did you know that about it? Or it's not really, but it was inspired by Jamie McCrimmon.
Oh, really? The writers wrote it because of him?
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a character that's basically Jamie. His name is Jamie.
And he's a Scottish Highlander.
Yeah.
From the same era. And he looks just like the actor they got, obviously looks like him, too.
Yeah, if they were going to recast, like, a new actor to play Jamie, they would definitely just cast this guy. And he's really good.
Yeah.
So there's some episodes, I have some episodes we didn't talk about yet. What did you guys think of the one with the emoji bots?
Yeah, I liked it. I liked that one.
I thought that one was a little weird. It reminded me a little bit of The Girl Who Waited. That's the one where, with the other helper bots, right? They reminded me of those helper bots immediately.
The last truly good episode.
That episode's great.
Don't get me started on The Girl Who Waited. That
and then there was the one with Poirot, when the haunted house where Bill's looking for an apartment, and Poirot shows up.
Yep. Do you know Poirot, Nick?
I can't remember the actor. I can't remember the actor's name. But he's,
You know Poirot?
Yeah, the TV station I work at runs it still.
Okay.
What's that actor's name? Why can't I remember it? David Suchet.
That's it.
It's fun to say.
Poirot.
They were going to, like, I read something, they were going to make him, like, related to Harry Sullivan from the old series, but they backed out on the last minute. Do you remember that character, Harry, with the Fourth Doctor?
No.
Okay.
I don't remember that one.
Oh, wait, Harry Sullivan, was he around when Sarah Jane was?
Yeah, yeah. He was in the first couple of seasons of
I do remember.
Tom Baker's stuff. Yeah.
So they were going to make him related to him?
Yeah, I don't know how, but apparently they're going to, like, have a tie to him.
That's a fucking reach.
Maybe that's why they didn't do it then, I don't know.
Do you ever get that feeling when you're watching it sometimes?
Like they're reaching for a connection?
Yeah, like they're really trying to force it.
I can't really think of an example, but...
I felt like, what was it, when the Brig came back as a Cyberman, I was like, fuck this!
That's reaching. That's reaching.
That was bad. No.
So offended by that. I was as offended by that as I am at the thought of Trump being in the Hall of Presidents. It's not... not cool. Don't disrespect the Brig.
If like they'd already given the Brig like a nice little moment at the end of an episode.
I agree. Killed the character, right? Yeah.
And now they got it sent off. They desecrated his grave by making him rise up from the dead, and then like he's alive again, but he's a Cyberman. Like, come on.
It would be his worst nightmare.
At the end of the first part of the finale, when I was watching the next time teaser, and you saw the modern Cybermen, I thought, oh. Don't tell me the Brig is going to show up with an army to help fight the other ones.
You didn't know how right you were.
The Doctor like sends out a distress beacon, and the Brigadier shows up with some new Cybermen to fight the old ones.
God. So yeah, that was a reach.
I thought the best cameo was at the end of the Ice Warriors, though, where Alpha Centauri comes back. Do you know Alpha Centauri? That alien?
I don't know it.
So at the end of that Ice Warriors episode, you know how there's like a transmission and like this character's talking to the Ice Warriors saying like, welcome to the universe or whatever?
Oh like, yeah, I remember that.
Welcome to the universe, Doctor! Like that thing. It was like I'm really gonna find it here. He was a character
Yes!
He was a character in the Pertwee, a couple of Pertwee stories.
This eyeball-looking thing.
Yeah, yeah. And since Gatiss wrote that episode, like, you know, he had to do it.
Of course. Of course. Thanks, Gatiss.
Gatiss loves them Ice Warriors. He loves them.
Did you ever play the game Maniac Mansion?
No.
This thing looks just like the tentacle from Maniac Mansion.
He's like a beloved, like, character that was in, like, two stories. He's pretty entertaining in the movie stuff.
Oh, here's a here's some inside baseball about the production of this character. The voice actor was instructed by the director to make the creature sound like a gay civil servant.
Okay. Surprisingly, they got the actor to come back for this, to voice over the character again for this story.
Excellent. The
person's like 96 or something.
Whoa, I love that. That's great.
Yeah, they're still alive and like, oh, can I just come back and voice this character again?
Excellent.
I thought it was just someone impersonating it, because, I mean, it's not that difficult to do, but that's pretty...
Oh, but they love to get back whoever they can, you know?
Yeah, they do.
And those people haven't had work in 30 years. They're thrilled.
Did you guys like the Ice Warriors episode?
Yeah, I did.
I thought it was really good. I love the Ice Warriors.
I thought it was much better than the other Ice Warriors one that they did a couple of seasons ago.
Oh, you didn't like
Cold War? Oh, no way, I love that one.
Lost and Unfound? Right. Come on, you don't like Duran Duran? That's what it is.
Ultravox, do they break up?
Yeah, come on.
Good episode.
It's got great lighting. You don't like the Blade Runner lighting?
Yeah, I mean, it was fine. I just didn't get into it as much as I thought I would.
Heartless!
What happened to the Sandman?
I've only watched it once.
Didn't they say they were going to wrap up the Sandman this season? With that... That found footage episode from last season. They said they were going to wrap that up, and they just didn't.
I think we should just forget about that terrible episode.
It's got that song, though. I love that song. Bum, 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 bum.
That was
bum,
just bum, bum, bad. Bum, bum, I just don't... It didn't justify what was happening at all. It's like, what is this? You sleep in your eyes. What? Come on.
They just wanted to get the rekindle the love of the Idiot's Lantern. Mm. Which is fine. It's a good episode.
Yeah, so I don't really know what else to say.
I think we talked about all the episodes.
We sort of jumped around a bit, but that's what we usually do when we do this Doctor Who thing. What are your hopes for the Christmas special, then, Elise? Like,
Don't suck.
I've got a lot of hopes. I hope it's so good. I just think it's really cool they're bringing David Bradley back.
Yeah. I was so... emotionally checked out for the last one that when it wasn't terrible, I was in shock. So really, it could go anywhere at this point for me.
I quite liked the Matt Smith regeneration episode. I thought it was kind of cool. Like, sad a bit. I don't know.
I didn't like that one.
I was sad to see him go, but I felt like he did not get the send-off he deserved. But I love him. He's a great actor. He's one of the better doctors, I think. He can do a monologue like nobody's business. Man, he got screwed. As an actor, I would be annoyed.
Hopefully he comes back in a couple of years and they do another multi-doctor story.
You know he would. He has love for that show.
I like, it's kind of cool, though, that he could just show up no matter how old he gets because they can just say, oh, this is like when he was aged this much on these last episodes.
Mm-hmm. Or he's just a curator now. I loved that about having Tom Baker back.
Some far-flung doctor.
Yeah, man, you can't top that for me. I don't cry every time I watch it or anything.
I'm just glad they squeezed Tom Baker in there, because, like, you know, he's not going to be around much longer, probably.
Don't say that!
It's like 85.
Don't talk about it.
Yeah.
I don't want to think about it.
He's got a whole bunch of Big Finish audios under his belt now, like Tom Baker.
Yeah, listen to a few of them. They're not bad. I mean, you just have to like the old Fourth Doctor, you know? Which I do, but it's just like, you know, because your favorite is the First Doctor. It's just a different style of storytelling. I think sometimes when people watch the new one and they go watch the old one, they're like, oh, this is terrible. It's like, no, it's just a different style.
Yeah, it takes a while to adjust to the slower paced story and, I don't know, just in general, 1970s TV.
And the show's figuring itself out the whole time.
Yeah, which that's part of it for me that's always, like, so fun to watch is watching the show mature.
It is interesting how, like, over the years, they just, like, you know, different writers and showrunners throw different things on top of the stuff that's already happened. It's like a.
Yeah.
Someone finishes telling a story and then someone just picks it right up and keeps going. Like, It's kind of surprising yep. that it hasn't just collapsed in on itself at some point, like, completely.
Yeah, I am surprised it's been the reboot has gone on this long.
Mm.
It feels like it might not go away now.
They say yeah, it'll be on forever. Good to, like,
until the end of peak TV.
2020 or whatever they're back till, I think.
Gosh.
So there's at least, like, another few years for sure, and then after that, who knows?
I think it could very well run longer than the original run did.
Well, the original run was, like, 1963 mm-hmm. to 89, so it's got a while to go.
Yeah.
It could do it.
It'll be interesting to see how it changes with this new slate coming.
Yeah, I'm glad that we're getting a new showrunner. I thought it felt like sort of felt like that Moffat was never going to leave.
I was like, I know!
Is he just going to, like, take it down with him? Is he just going to keep going until they cancel it or something? Like, wow, he's been doing it since, what, 2010?
Yeah.
Mm. He's done 6 seasons, which is a lot. I mean, there've only been 10 seasons, and he did 6 of them.
Yeah.
So. I think just like how the show needs a new doctor every couple of years to, like, refresh everything and make it feel new again, changing the showrunner almost as often, like maybe like every 2 or maybe 3 doctors, is an absolute necessity.
Yeah, yeah.
4 years max.
I think, yeah, 4 to 5 years for a showrunner would be enough, and then, like, give someone else a go.
Yeah, I think each showrunner gets a minimum of 2 doctors, I think. Maybe they get 2.5, and there's some bleed over, maybe not. But I think each of them should get at least 2.
Okay, well, I think we might just leave it there.
All right.
Thanks for coming yeah. on and have a chat about Doctor Who again, guys.
Thanks. Amanda, the next time we'll talk, you'll probably be married and have kids. Another 2 years.
Like 3 years away.
Yeah.
Let's not leave it that long.
Okay.
Okay. All right, so...
Wiedersehen. Yeah.
Thanks for listening, everyone, and we'll talk to you next time. Bye.
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 Upon my ship on Christmas Day, I was fair, so I gave him a chance. You shouldn't be here, what's your tale? I ought to throw you to the whale. He just smiled and said, come here, let's dance. He said, far I will see, I'll find a way to be with my lover upon Christmas Day. And I'll run and I'll roam, I'll cover the ground. This Christmas I'll see you, I'll be around. He told me about his girl back home, waiting patient all alone. While we danced I shed a little tear. He closed his eyes all out at sea. I think he danced with her, not me. I'll just have to wait another year. He said, for I will steal, I'll find a way to be with my lover upon Christmas Day. And I'll run and I'll roam, I'll cover the ground. This Christmas I'll see you, I'll be around. I think of him now and again. I wonder how his journey ends. As I sail by on my lonesome sea, that stranger with the haunting face, here then gone without a trace, lying with his love, that's where he'll be. That borrow or steal, I'll find a way to be with my lover next Christmas Day. And I'll run and I'll roam, I'll cover the ground. Next Christmas I'll see you, I'll be around. That borrow or steal, I'll find a way to be with my lover next Christmas Day. And I'll run and I'll roam, I'll cover the ground. Next Christmas I'll see you, I'll be around. My love. you are.